I'm Alice.
And I'm Brett.
And this is The Prosecutor's Legal Brief. Welcome back to The Prosecutor's Legal Briefs. I'm your host, Alice, and I'm joined, as always, by my grand co-host, Brett.
Hello, Alice. That was, I don't know, that was a little too easy. A little too easy for you, Alice.
Give it to me. Sleep deprivation is real, and I am on a sugar high because I ate cake with my hands. I didn't tell you that part. A fork was not involved.
You didn't mention that. I knew about the cake. I didn't realize you were just eating it with
your hands.
I was
eating it like an animal.
Because
I was like, if you get a fork out, then you've like, you know, you've completely just given in to the fact that you're eating cake. But if you're just picking at it with your hands, it's like, am I really eating cake? Surely I'm not.
I'm convinced. I hear if you eat it with your hand, it doesn't have any calories either.
Absolutely. Like, if you cut it, calories fly out too. These are all like natures of dieting, the laws of dieting. You should not sign up for my diet plan.
You may not have a lot of success if you do. No, but Alice, it was a great pun. I give you all the credit in the world.
Thank you. It is a fantastic pun, guys, because we thought we would talk about grand juries today. We've covered them, you know, as we've talked about cases, but I think there's still some confusion about what a grand jury is, when you have to use it, what happens in a grand jury. And those are all very good questions because the grand jury is not open to the public. So obviously, as a prosecutor, which Brett and I have been, we are in the grand jury room. So we get to kind of give you a view into what grand juries do and what happens in that room that you'll actually never be able to see as the public.
Yeah. And we just did an episode a few weeks ago on petite juries and jury selection. And you guys were really interested in that. We got a lot of people who followed up with, tell us more about grand juries. And like Alice said, they come up all the time and we talk about them all the time in our cases. We talked about the Brian Koberger case recently. We talked a little bit about grand juries and how they work and the difference between a grand jury and a preliminary hearing. We'll talk about that a little bit. But for the most part, we want to give you sort of a view behind the curtain about what happens with grand juries. The first thing is sort of how they're selected. We talked a lot about jury selection for a trial, and it's very involved, and we went through all sorts of different things. You know, one thing I'll mention about that, there were some people who were upset because you felt like we were stereotyping, and we talked about how juries are selected, and I just want to make sure it's clear, we absolutely were talking about stereotyping. That is what happens in jury selection, is stereotyping 100%, because you have prosecutors and defense attorneys, they have very limited information, they're doing the best they can. A lot of times they're wrong, but you take all you have and you go with it.
And that's absolutely right, Brett. I mean, if you've ever seen a jury be picked, and you're not going to be able to see the whole thing because a lot of the jury picking is done kind of in secret, you know, even if you're in the public courtroom, each of the sets of attorneys have their own process. They're trying to shield it from the other side because they don't want to give away their strategy. And they're trying to, you know, speak in hushed tones and also work quickly. And you have to do that because you have sometimes minutes, maybe seconds, to tell the judge if you want to strike a juror or leave them be. In other words, they'll be on your jury. You know, the judge won't sit there all day and say, okay, take all the time you need. Quite literally, it sometimes goes like this. You know, jurors are given numbers and the judge will say something like, okay, jurors 1 through 10, prosecution, what do you say? Do you keep them all or strike them? And if you're silent for more than like 60 seconds or so, the judge starts saying, we don't have all day. You know, attorneys, what do you have to say? I mean, it's very like down to the wire. You have to think on your feet. And the best you can do is to draw kind of these stereotypes. And stereotypes, I think, have a negative connotation. This is meant just as a neutral matter. You're trying to think, okay, what can I know about someone if they have this level of education based on where they live? Are they in the country? Are they in the suburbs? Are they in the city? You know, how many children they have? They don't have children. What they like to read, what they like to listen to. You're doing everything you can to make sense of someone with limited information. We know from speaking to all of you, just because you all listen to this podcast, no way would all of you fall into the same stereotype. But there's obviously a lot of diversity, even if people have the same answers. And that's why, you guys, going to a petite jury and having a trial before a petite jury is truly a black box. And it's like rolling the dice. It is ultimately rolling the dice because you do not know everything about the people who are sitting on your jury.
It's entirely true what Alice is saying. And just put yourself in the situation of a defendant. Imagine you're a defendant for a second. And imagine that your defense is the police framed me. This is a police frame job. They totally framed me. This is corrupt cops doing this. And you get a juror who their entire family have been police officers and they have a back the blue bumper sticker on the back of their car. Are you going to take that into account when you're thinking about whether or not you want your attorney to strike them? You probably are. Now, in reality, that person, they may hold police officers to an even higher standard because they have that history with the police and they believe the police need to be absolutely honorable and any hint of corruption, they're going to hammer. But you don't know that. All you can do is the best you can do. And it is a black box. And I don't want to make this all about petite juries, but what's interesting is lawyers, defendants have a lot of say in who ends up on a petite jury. Grand jury is completely different. Grand jury is selected in much the same way as a petite jury in that there is some selection process. Oftentimes, it has to do with voter registration. It can be motor vehicle registration. There's a lot of different ways they do it. The advantage to voter registration in a lot of places is if you're a felon, you can't vote, and you can't be on a jury in a lot of states. So, if you're registered to vote, that means you're probably someone who can be on a jury, and you'll get a summons, and you can be summoned to the grand jury. And basically, they bring in a pool of people, and they being the officers of the court and the grand jury coordinators and the judge who oversees that district sort of determine who out of that pool are going to be the 16 or the 20 or however many people in that jurisdiction they're going to have on this grand jury. And the way a grand jury works is it's not like a petite jury. You don't serve on just one case. If you're on a petite jury, you get a trial, you do that trial, and usually there's some period of time, 2 years, 3 years, maybe even more, where you don't have to serve on a jury again. You won't be called to jury duty again. Grand juries are very different. Grand juries often serve for a set length of time, can be 6 months, can be a year, and they meet and consider indictments on a whole lot of different cases. Now, they don't meet every day. It's not for a year you're on grand jury and that's your job. In a lot of places, there's basically 1 week a month where the grand jury convenes for some period of time during that week. And depending on how many indictments they have to hear, they might be there the whole week. They may be there a day. Some jurisdictions have grand jury once a year or twice a year. And that's it, unless they have a special grand jury. We'll talk about those in a second. Others have grand jury once a month. I worked in a place once that had three grand juries going at the same time. And basically, every month, 3 weeks out of the four, there was a grand jury working. And there was only that 1 week when there wasn't. And there was a lot of cases being processed through that district, obviously. And that's why they had so
many.
That
is going to be a very busy jurisdiction.
Yeah, and it was. It was.
That's a huge, you can see the massive spectrum in the busyness of the jurisdiction. What Brett just described is probably going to be one of the busiest jurisdictions in the country. The jurisdiction that has like one to two grand juries a year is going to be a much, much slower jurisdiction. And you can imagine that to be the case. You know, a bustling city, you know, one of the top 10 cities is going to have many, many, many cases. And then a very rural town that's pretty sleepy, doesn't have a lot of crime, is just not going to have a need for grand jury as much. And if you're thinking, geez, being called or being on call, you know, 1 week out of a month for 12 months at a time seems like a lot. It is. I mean, it really is a service to your country. You know, it's not quite like being in the military, but in essence, you know, a lot of judges explain it to grand jurors that this is the way they're serving their country. And you can imagine people's jobs aren't always happy about it. If you have a court order to show up, your job, you know, there are protections for you with your employer. Your employer can't keep you from complying with the order. You know, can't be fired for it. Obviously, in real life, it can cause a lot of hardships for people, but there are basically limited number of hardships that people can show that will get them excused from grand jury. I worked with people in my law office who were put on grand juries. I don't know how they made it on the grand jury, but that was a lot of work because in the law, you have other deadlines set by other courts who are not going to take the fact that you're serving on a grand jury to give you extensions. And so what my colleague did was every time she served on the grand jury, she would just have to work late into the night to finish what she couldn't do during the day when she was serving on the grand jury. So it is a lot of work, but it truly is important for basically ensuring our constitutional protections for criminal defendants.
And you can also understand something else we've talked about, why a lot of cases in the states do not go to a grand jury. So in the federal system, we've talked about this before, you have a constitutional right to an indictment by grand jury for any felony. If you're indicted for a federal misdemeanor, you don't have to have a grand jury. But if you're indicted for a felony, grand jury has to indict you. There's no way around it. That's the way it has to work. I think maybe you can waive it, I guess. But in any event, ordinarily, you have to have that grand jury indict you. In the states, you don't have to. And so some states choose to use grand juries less. We talked about how in some places you might have one grand jury, two grand juries a year. You can also see in that circumstance why so many cases go to these preliminary hearings where probable cause is found there. The whole purpose of a grand jury is to determine whether or not there is probable cause to believe a crime was committed by the person who has been indicted. They get the indictment. It's been prepared by the prosecutor. It charges a crime, whatever it is. You know, say it's one count of murder. You know, on such and such date, in such and such place, the defendant, you know, or whatever his name is, did unlawfully kill X, right? Might be your indictment. The grand jury is listening to evidence that the prosecution is going to put on, and they're going to make a determination at the end of that presentation. Is there enough evidence to believe a crime likely happened here and that this is the person who did it? If there is, they're going to return what's called a true bill, which means we are voting to say there is probable cause, we're returning the indictment, the case can move forward. If there's not, then they would not return a true bill, and that case would go away. Unless the prosecution wanted to attempt to bring another indictment, that person, nothing's going to happen to them. That can also happen in a preliminary hearing. We talked about this in Brian Koberger in Idaho. So far, it seems like they're going to move forward in that case with a preliminary hearing where evidence will be put on before a judge, and the judge will make that same determination. And you can imagine, if you have a grand jury that's only meeting once every couple, twice a year, right? Well, say the grand jury met last week, and then this week you've got a murder that just popped up, and you need to arrest somebody, and you need to get them indicted. Well, you're not going to wait 6 months for the new grand jury to roll around, right? You're going to go ahead and take that preliminary route. What is the advantage to doing a grand jury for a prosecution, at least? Well, one thing about it is it's secret. Obviously, hearings are held publicly. Very rarely do you have closed hearings. The public has a right to go to these preliminary hearings, to know what's going on in them. There are certain ways they can be sealed. There are certain things that can be sealed. But generally speaking, in this country, hearings are held publicly. Grand jury is not. Grand jury is secret. Grand jury secrecy is a very important thing. And if you violate grand jury secrecy, it's a really bad thing. And the reason we do that is we don't even want it to be public that someone is being looked at for an indictment, that people are testifying, and you can imagine the reasons why. What if at the end of the day, the grand jury doesn't return that true bill? You don't want that person's reputation to be sullied because they were the target of an investigation that it turned out there wasn't even enough probable cause to bring an action against them. Why would you want witnesses to be secret? Well, you don't always want the person who is the subject of investigation to know who it is that is testifying against them. You can imagine all the reasons that would be a problem. So, ordinarily, until you get to trial, what happens in the grand jury is a complete black box. The defense wouldn't even know who testified. There is a requirement under something called jinx that the prosecution provide grand jury testimony if that person is going to testify. So that's when it becomes available. And we've talked about this before, how you have to think about who you're going to put in grand jury, because if you're going to use that person at trial, if that person's going to testify, then the defense is going to know what they said. And if what they say at trial is different from what they said in front of the grand jury, that can be a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And the grand jury, also something to keep in mind is that There's no picking of the grand jury in the sense of the petit jury we last time talked about, decision making by the defense and the prosecution to decide who they want. It's really not who you decide to be on the jury. It's actually the opposite. You decide who you don't want to be on the jury. There's no similar voir dire process with the grand jury. So it really is the like first X number of people who get the summons who don't have some valid excuse being like you're a single mother and there's no one else to care for your children, or maybe you have some medical reason that prevents you from being able to sit for long periods of time, those sorts of things. If there's no valid excuse that has nothing to do with your biases, I guess you can say, you're put on the grand jury. And it's like that because you really are trying to just get a slice of the population to see if the prosecution is able to meet that lower standard of probable cause. So in essence, the grand jury is like the public for you, even though it's not open to the public. So the grand jurors get to hear all of this information, even if they ultimately vote not to indict a particular criminal defendant. They've seen all of it. So they're kind of like in some way standing in for the public who get to see typical court proceedings.
And another way it's different from the petit jury is it doesn't have to be unanimous. There's usually, I think the rule is you do have to have 12 people vote to indict, but you might have 18 people on the grand jury and you might present to them and maybe some of them don't vote to return the indictment. Well, it doesn't actually matter. If you get that number, that's sufficient. And at that point, the foreman is going to sign that indictment. And at that point, that indictment is going to go forward. And, you know, one thing that's really interesting about grand juries is, well, number one, there are two types of them. There's an investigative grand jury and there's a grand jury, I don't really know what I would call it, but it's a grand jury that does things like return indictments. And an investigative grand jury may eventually return one, but what it also may do is literally just conduct an investigation. This grand jury is called together. And why do you want to do that? Number one, as Alice just said, this is the public sort of gathering information. You know, all of this is so core to democracy. Now, people knock grand juries all the time because they're like, oh, they'll indict a ham sandwich. Why do we waste our time with this? Well, we do it for the same reason we do a lot of things, because we want the public involved in government. We want public making decisions. We want the public checking prosecutors. We want to have these checks and balances that keep government from just being able to do whatever it wants. And you're bringing the public in these investigative grand juries, and you're using them to call in witnesses to get information from them that is helpful for you in your ongoing investigation. You're not at a place where you're ready to ask a grand jury to return an indictment. You're not ready to say, we can show probable cause a crime was committed and that's the person who did it. But you're using the power of the grand jury. Now, what does that mean? You guys have all heard about subpoenas. And subpoenas to do this and subpoenas to do that. Subpoenas are almost always connected to some sort of court matter. So there are trial subpoenas where you are subpoenaed to appear at court at a certain time for a trial and to bring every document you have and be prepared to testify. There are also grand jury subpoenas. Grand jury subpoenas make you come to the grand jury for the same reason. The advantage of a grand jury subpoena are a couple things. Number one, a lot of times, if what we're really looking for are documents, say you're a bank, you don't actually have to send the president of the bank down to the grand jury to talk about, you know, Mr. Smith's account. You can just return the documents, the records that the prosecuting authority wants to look at, and you've satisfied your obligation. Or you can subpoena individuals and force them to come. Usually, you can't make people come talk to you if you're a prosecutor. You guys all know that. Everybody's got rights, right? I can ask you to come in. I can come to you. I can knock on your door with a police officer and say, hey, will you talk to me about this? And you can slam the door in my face and there's nothing I can do about it unless I have a grand jury, in which case I can knock on your door again, hand you a grand jury subpoena and tell you I'll see you there. And I can talk to you in front of the grand jury and I can get the information out of you that I want to, and you'll be under oath and under the penalty of perjury. And unless you can claim the Fifth Amendment, you're going to have to answer those questions. So it's a really powerful tool for doing investigations and for getting the kind of information you want to get so that you can get to the point where you can start asking someone we want to return an indictment. There's been a crime committed here.
Yeah, that's a great point. A lot of people think it's just used for true bills or indictments, but that subpoena power, that investigative power of the grand jury, is actually the bulk of the administrative work of the grand jury. And I find this to be really, really powerful, because something that people don't know is that the grand jury is just that. It's for investigating. Once a case is indicted, you can't use the investigative power of the grand jury to further investigate a case that's already been indicted. You have to use different processes. You still use subpoenas, but administratively, there's something different. And the whole idea is that you're not going to have one all-powerful district attorney's office or prosecutor's office who just gets to wave their magic wand and kind of rove around the society and say, we have all power to investigate all things. I mean, that's kind of a scary amount of power to give one office that could go unchecked. But what stands between kind of that world and where we live today is the grand jury, who filters through all of those subpoenas. And so when an entity receives a subpoena, whether it's bank for records or an individual for testimony, if it's records, it technically goes to the prosecution, but the prosecution has to do something called return the records to the grand jury. And it may just seem like it's just a pro forma or something like that, but technically the grand jury has the right to inspect those documents. And again, it goes back to the fact that it's the grand jury that's asking for these documents. It's not just, you know, this roving band of prosecutors. And so in reality, most grand juries don't want to look at a bunch of bank records, but this all is built in because if there became a situation where prosecutors were really running around with massive amounts of power going seemingly unchecked, the grand jury can actually step up, right? So far, everyone has abided and kind of stayed within their lane, which is why we haven't had to bring in millions of documents of pages to the grand jury for them to inspect before they turn it over to the prosecution for them to be able to investigate whether an indictment should be brought. But these processes are in place for the situation in which we have kind of a coup or a takeover. You don't have to create more systems. So I think that's really important. Even if it seems like we don't make use of these checks and balances, I think it's very important to know that these checks and balances do exist. There is something that can be done if you have a rogue prosecutor's office trying to wield more power than they are allowed.
Yeah, and there's a couple things I'll add to that. The grand jury could always ask about those documents. You know, if you put out a bunch of subpoenas to look at a bunch of documents and then you're asking them to return some sort of indictment and you never mention any of those documents, you might get some questions from the grand jury. We're going to talk about in a second. It's a back and forth process. The grand jury doesn't sit there silently like they do in petite juries often. Another thing about the subpoenas, there are a couple reasons you want to do grand jury subpoenas. And we've talked about this before. Grand juries force prosecutors to have their case together before indictment. And they do it in a couple ways. Number one, you're going to have to go in front of these people and present your case. And you don't want to look an idiot, and you don't want to look like your case is weak and has a bunch of holes. You want to have a solid case that you can present to these folks so they're going to, without question, return an indictment and not question the fact you have probable cause. And just forcing you to go through that process is important and make sure that you know the strengths of your case and maybe some of the weaknesses, too, that you need to fix. That's the first thing. The second thing, once they return that indictment, as Alice said, the power of the grand jury, you can't use them anymore to seek those subpoenas. Now you're going to need something like a trial to get a subpoena. Well, number one, it might take a while before the trial gets set. So before the trial gets set, there's sort of a period there where it's actually kind of hard to get anything because getting those subpoenas is hard. Once a trial gets set, say, okay, got a trial, going to issue a trial subpoena because I really want to talk to this person. You give them the trial subpoena and they're like, okay, I'll see you at trial. And you're like, well, I mean, actually, I'd love to talk to you before trial. No, this says trial, I'll see you at trial. And you just have to show up at trial. You've never talked to this person and just hope that when they get on the stand or when they bring you documents, that the documents are going to say what you want them to say and they're going to say what you want them to say on the stand. Much better to already have that person lined up and locked down at grand jury so that your trial process will be smoother. So if you take grand jury seriously and you use it in a serious manner, it's going to make your case much better and it's going to make trial go much better as well. So how does it work when you get in grand jury? As we said, the whole purpose of this is to present evidence so that you can show there should be an indictment. And the way it typically goes, and you can use a simple case, you might call a bunch of people. Imagine, for instance, there is someone, police go into an apartment. There are two people in the apartment. There's a gun on the table. One of the people in the apartment never been in trouble before in their life. The other one is a felon. Felon can't possess a firearm. The other person can. You can imagine an easy defense here for the felon. Not my gun, it was their gun. I wasn't in possession of it, they were, right? So one thing you might want to do is call that other person the grand jury and ask them a bunch of questions and get them to say things like, wasn't my gun, it was the other guy's gun, and explain how they know that and sort of give some evidence that will convince not only this jury, but a future jury that in fact, it was that other person's. So you might call a witness like that. A lot of times, though, what you end up doing is you call the investigative officer or one of the investigative officers, and they come in, they get sworn in, just like it was for a trial. There is no judge. There is no defense attorney. There are no objections. So you, as the prosecutor, really control the room. And that puts some responsibilities on you, and it puts some burdens on you that I think some people don't really understand. Number one, you can lead them all day because there's no one to object, but you really shouldn't. You should get the evidence out of them in a way that is natural and allows a witness to testify, not the prosecutor. You should only put admissible evidence in. There's no one there to object to hearsay. There's no one there to object to 404B. And it's not like you can't put some of that in. You can, because the rules are looser. But when you get that indictment, you really want it to be based on all the same evidence you can introduce at trial. Because if you don't, maybe you're building a bomb into your own case. The other thing, you ask all these questions to this officer. Well, at the end of that, you turn to the grand jury and you say, y'all got anything? And they are allowed to ask questions of the witness. This is done in different ways, in different jurisdictions. In some jurisdictions, they ask directly. In others, the witness leaves and they ask the prosecutor the questions they would like to hear. And then the prosecutor asks them of the witness when they come back in. So that's one thing they do. The other thing they do is the prosecutor is explaining the law to them. They're not lawyers. There's no judge. They don't get a jury instruction or a charge. So at the very beginning of it all, you're reading them the indictment. You're telling them what the elements are. What do we have to show? What do we have to prove? They can ask you questions. If he did this, is that enough? You know, what does interstate mean? They can ask all those sort of questions about the law, and they ask those to the lawyer, and the lawyer asks those. If they have factual questions, those are supposed to go to the witness.
Yeah, that's a really great point, Brett. And part of the nice thing about it being more relaxed, even though you can fall into a pit, you know, you're not building a good case if you're the prosecution and not asking good questions. The fact that the rules are more relaxed, I think also makes everything that's happening in that room more accessible to the grand jurors, because you're not using a bunch of legalese. There's no kind of the legal rules that everyone has to play by, because again, what Brett just said, there's not another side that's helping explain things to the grand jury. What's happening? You know, this is what the prosecution is doing. Let me explain to you their tactics. There's no judge to help explain or keep order. I think it kind of makes everyone speak regular language as well, because you want the grand jurors to understand. And here's the thing, you know, Brett and I have been before many, 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 many grand juries, and they do listen. It's actually amazing. Even if they've heard a gun case over and over and over, and it seems like it's the most boring thing in the world because they hear dozens of those, you know, maybe each sitting. They really do kind of pick up on things that are missing from a case. And I've definitely had tough questions asked to me by the grand jurors. So it is not just as easy as indicting a ham sandwich. In fact, I have decided, based on questions that jurors have raised, you know, very skeptical questions about my case, decided not to present it to the grand jury to vote on, because I've decided, you know, this is, with those types of questions, valid questions, not a good case. Even if for some reason they vote for a true bill, I don't want to take this case to trial. It's not ready yet. So just know that the court system is working. You may not see this all the time. You just see the effect, right? Which is that a lot of cases are indicted, but you will not be able to see how many cases were not indicted or how many cases were issued in which there were subpoenas issued and there was an investigation that led to no indictment. This is all the process working.
And you can, if you get to the end of your grand jury session, and you're feeling like Alice just described, and you're thinking, man, I don't know. I feel like I need to issue some more of those subpoenas. You can say, I'm not going to ask for an indictment right now. See you guys later. will come back later. Hopefully it's not their last session, because if it's their last session, then you're going to have to do the whole thing in front of a new grand jury. But you can do that if that's what you need to do, and you have a lot of control over that. The other thing, the big thing, really, that I think most people have no understanding of, exculpatory evidence. Talk about exculpatory evidence a lot. Once again, it's just evidence that tends to cast doubt on guilt. There is no defense attorney to return that. And the grand jury, remember, what they're doing is they're weighing the evidence and they're trying to determine whether or not there's probable cause. It's not as if, as a prosecutor, you walk in and have to tell them every single bad thing about your case. But if there are some things that they should know, you do need to let them know. I'll give you an example. What we just talked about, the guy with the gun. Say you decided not to call the roommate for whatever reason. You're not going to call the roommate. You don't want to call him yet. You don't want to put him in grand jury. You shouldn't have the officer just say, yeah, we went in, defendant was there, there was a gun on the table, we arrested him, we charged him with this. The jury should know. The grand jury should know there was another person in there. And you should ask, was there anybody else in there? Yeah. Who was it? Oh, it was a roommate. Do you have any reason to believe it's his weapon? Well, no, because of these reasons. Okay, so you have just given them the exculpatory evidence, and actually the likely defense is it's the other person's. And then maybe you've presented some reasons why they should assume, okay, that's not great that there was another guy there. I can see how that could be a defense, but it sounds like it's not him. It's probably the other guy's gun. We have probable cause. We're going to find that. And this is one of those things where the line is really murky about what you have to present and what you don't. You really just need to go in there with good faith. And the knowledge that while it is extremely difficult to challenge a grand jury indictment, it is possible. There are challenges to the indictment, and you can get in a lot of trouble as a prosecutor if some judge decides that you were misleading the grand jury or you were doing something improper in grand jury, because there's so much on you. There's no one else there. And a lot of people will never know what's said in grand jury unless for some reason the defense ends up with some right to access of the transcript. So this is another place where there is a heightened burden and a heightened duty on prosecutors because of their position.
And not only should you do that because it's the right thing to do and your bar license could be at risk if you were to mislead the grand jury, but here's the other thing. You get a shot to test your exculpatory evidence on a jury of peers to see how they react, because that evidence will absolutely come out later if the case is indicted and you go to trial. And you need to know how people will react. You may think you know how a certain evidence that's exculpatory affects your case, but maybe it hits totally differently to the general public. You know, maybe you've been looking at it through a legal lens, and that's just not the way most people will view the situation. You get to test that. It's really great. There is question and answer from the grand jury in a way that there is not with the petit jury. The petit jury can never talk directly to the attorneys. They always have to talk to the court, the judge, and the judge can ask those questions to the attorneys, but there's never direct question asking from the petit jury to the attorneys. In the grand jury, you actually get to have a conversation with your grand jurors. They get to ask questions at the end of every presentation for an indictment. You get to answer it. Sometimes you have to call back witnesses to answer if they're factual questions. The witness has to come back under oath and answer those questions. If they're legal questions, they can ask you those. Again, those are not things that happen in a trial. And so if you're getting a lot of those kind of critical questions about how they react to certain exculpatory evidence, that's great for you, because maybe even though legally you think you have a strong case, if the way people see it is going to be much more critical, you might want to rethink your case and think whether that exculpatory evidence may, even with the exculpatory evidence, your case may meet probable cause, but maybe it won't meet beyond a reasonable doubt. And is it worth kind of doing the whole judicial process, all of the resources, if there's not a likelihood of conviction at the end of the day? You know, that you have to really think hard about that.
Yeah. And look, like I said earlier, grand juries, they get a lot of flack from a lot of people. But I think it's because unless you work in this area, if you've served on grand jury, I'll tell you this, people who serve on grand jury usually have a great experience. They usually, not everybody who serves on a jury does. You can get a pretty boring case. Great thing about grand jury is if the last case was boring, the next one might not be. And I think a lot of people really enjoy it and really like that opportunity to serve. There are so many things going on behind the scenes, though, that make the judicial system work better and more smoothly. And I think grand juries are great. I think it's unfortunate that they seem to be falling out of favor in a lot of states, frankly. In the United States, the federal system, they'll be around as long as there's the Constitution. So presumably they're not going to change that anytime soon. But yeah, I hope you guys have enjoyed this. Alice, I feel like we've covered everything about grand juries. Is there anything else you think we should mention?
You know who always tell us if we don't? Our wonderful listeners.
That's true. That's true.
No, this has been really fun because I forget that this is not something open to the public that other people don't get a view into. So we hope we've been able to, you know, shine a light on a very important part of our judicial system that gives you comfort that, you know, we do have protections in place. And as much as we joke about the grand jury just being there to indict a ham sandwich, that's not really the case. The result of what you see may seem to be that way, but there's so much that happens behind closed doors, as it should be behind closed doors, but it doesn't always stay in the dark. If the case is indicted, it does come to light. So, you know, the fears of prosecutorial misconduct and whatnot, the good thing is those things do come to light. Both Brett and I have seen situations where things have gone awry in a grand jury and steps are taken to rectify it. So I hope this helps you understand our judicial system a little bit better and also to appreciate the systems we have in place to protect all of yours and our constitutional rights. With that said, Brett, is there anything else you'd like to add before we sign off for the day?
Just that thank you guys for continuing to give us good topics to cover. And as Alice said, if you have more questions about grand juries or petite juries or really any aspect of the judicial system, I hope you will let us know because we love talking about this stuff with you guys.
Absolutely. Well, Brett, we're recording this on a Friday night, and I texted Brett because my schedule's all over the place, and I said, hey, it's Friday night. I know you might have plans, but can you record tonight? And Brett laughed like, ha, 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 a million texts and said, it's great that you think I have plans on a Friday night. So, Brett, thanks for not having plans on a Friday night.
I mean, actually, I was exonic when you initially texted me.
Again, I was trying to save you, not to throw you under the bus that you are yet again as Sonic.
I do love Sonic. Somebody asked me if I get paid by Sonic. The opposite is true, my friend. I pay Sonic. I pay Sonic for the pleasure of waiting there for long periods of time for their diet cherry limeade.
I was going to say, you not only pay for your cherry limeade, you pay with your time.
I do. I pay with my life. Moments of my life.
Oh,
but it's okay.
Goodness.
Well worth it.
Well worth it. Well, Brett, it's always a joy getting to talk to you. And thank you guys so much. Make sure to hit us up with any questions at prosecutorspod@gmail.com. Visit us on Twitter, Facebook. We have a wonderful fan-run page called The Gallery on Facebook. And yeah, we love you guys. Come back next week for yet another interesting topic that I don't know what it is yet. So hopefully you guys come up with a topic for us soon. Until next time, I'm Alice.
And I'm Brett.
And this is the Prosecutor's Legal Briefs. Well, so you caught me eating cake.
I did. I feel like I always catch you eating something.
Wow, that's embarrassing. So I've had this cake, and I've like looked at it. I have it in like a pretty little cake holder, you know, like where you have the top and it's like clear and it's really pretty.
Yeah.
And I've had so much self-control and like not eaten it all week. And then all self-control
broke
down.
It's Friday night.
I was going to say, Friday night I was going wild, so I decided to break into it, and then you called and caught me in it.
There you go.